Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Greg Daniel, Managing Director and Fellow at the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform at Brookings. Thank you all for joining us for our continuing series of public webinars on active medical product surveillance. Today, we'll hear about findings from a mini-sentinel medical product assessment on influenza vaccines and looking at the risk of febrile seizures. First, I'd like to give a little background on where we are and how we got here. As many of you know, the announcement of the Sentinel Initiative followed the passage of the Food and Drug Amendments Act of 2007. FDA mandated that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration develop a national electronic system for monitoring medical product safety after these products reach the market. The Sentinel system is designed to improve FDA's capability to identify and evaluate safety issues in near real time, enhance the agency's ability to evaluate these issues not easily evaluated with the passive surveillance systems currently in place, and last but not least, to augment but not replace the existing safety monitoring systems that FDA uses. Sentinel's pilot project is called Mini-Sentinel. Mini-Sentinel uses electronic healthcare data, including administrative claims and electronic clinical data, to conduct active surveillance. Mini-Sentinel has far surpassed the data access goals put forth by Congress and FDA, and regularly provides FDA with rapid and actionable information on post-market utilization of medical products, occurrence of health outcomes of interest, and potential safety risks related to the use of specific medical products. While Mini-Sentinel is capable of safety surveillance on a variety of medical products, the Post-Licensure Rapid Immunization Safety Monitoring Program, or PRISM, was established exclusively for vaccine safety surveillance within Mini-Sentinel. PRISM has helped to address key gaps in vaccine safety monitoring capabilities within the United States. PRISM investigators are currently assessing a variety of associations between vaccinations and potential health outcomes of interest. Today, we'll hear findings of an assessment that examined possible association between the use of certain inactivated influenza vaccines and the occurrence of febrile seizures in children. We'll have some opening comments from Michael Nguyen, Deputy Director in the Division of Epidemiology at the Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research within FDA. Following Michael's opening comments, Allison Kuai is an epidemiologist from the Department of Population Medicine at Harvard Medical School and Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Institute. Allison will provide an overview of the results of the analysis. Before both of these presentations, I'd like to go over just a few housekeeping items. I'd quickly like to encourage you to submit questions throughout today's presentations. You can submit your questions at any time during this webinar online in the WebEx portal by using the chat tab at the lower right-hand side of your screen as you think of them, and they will be put into queue. After both presentations, I'll go in order that the questions were submitted, and I'll ask each of you to unmute your line and go ahead and read your question. Just as a reminder, all of your phones have automatically been muted by the WebEx system. In order for anyone to speak, you'll need to dial *7 to unmute your line. Also, make sure that the mute button on your phone is unmuted. If during this process you experience any technical questions, please call the WebEx technical support at 1-866-229-3239 or the Level 3 conferencing at 1-888-447-1119. I'd like to now turn the presentation over to Michael Nguyen at FDA. Michael, if you're on the line, please press *7 to unmute and go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Okay, great. Good afternoon. You're about to hear a wonderful presentation by Dr. Allison Kuai, the lead investigator of the PRISM Febrile Seizures Study. The PRISM Febrile Seizures Study was launched in October of 2011 after the first time that febrile seizures had been linked to influenza vaccination in the United States. To give you a sense of the overall study timeline, the study protocol was posted on the Mini-Sentinel website for public comment in January of 2013, and the final report was posted in May of 2014. So from start to finish, the study took about 2.5 years to finish, an astonishing feat considering that it is the largest study of febrile seizures in a single season in the United States with statistical power to detect the relative risk of 2. Moreover, the claims data in this PRISM study proved to be extremely reliable. With positive predictive value to identify febrile seizures between 70 and 91%, depending on the algorithm that we chose. In the next several slides, I'll provide a brief introduction as to why we're studying febrile seizures and influenza vaccination, and why it continues to be important to FDA and other regulators. Next slide, please. So febrile seizures, defined as seizures or convulsions accompanied by fever in children aged 6 through 59 months without evidence of central nervous system infection, metabolic abnormality, or underlying seizure disorder. The precise link between fever and seizure is not clear, but it is thought to be a generally benign condition that is rarely associated with any neurologic sequelae. Children who suffer from a febrile seizure have a slightly elevated risk of developing epilepsy or long-term seizure disorder compared to the general population. Next click, please. The American Academy of Pediatrics estimates that febrile seizures occur in children in about 2 to 5% of children aged less than 5 years of age and are associated with viral and bacterial infections. The risk is higher after whole cell pertussis and measles containing vaccines. There's an overall 35% recurrence rate among children who suffer from febrile seizures, which is even higher if those seizures occur in younger children. Next slide, please. So this slide illustrates the importance of monitoring for febrile seizures after vaccination. Febrile seizures, as I said previously, was first associated with influenza vaccination in the 2010 Southern Hemisphere season. In Australia, CSL Fluvax trivalent inactivated vaccine was found to have an unexpected increased risk of just under 9 cases per 1,000 doses administered. The onset was typically within 8 hours post-vaccination. Next click, please. This resulted in multiple public health interventions worldwide, notably the suspension of the mass vaccination program in Australia among children less than 5 years of age, as well as recommendations against the use of CSL Efluria in the United States for children 6 months through 8 years of age by the ACIP, or Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. FDA also added data to the warnings and precautions section of CSL Efluria's prescribing information and restricted the indication for use to children age 5 years and older. Next slide, please. The Australian experience is one of many motivating events for launching the PRISM febrile seizure study. However, there are also many unique features of influenza vaccines in general that make it a long-term strategic safety monitoring priority for FDA. First, influenza vaccines have the widest ACIP recommendation for use among all vaccines. It has been routinely recommended for all persons aged greater than 6 months of age since 2010. In fact, since 2010, between 130 and 163 million doses were distributed in the United States every year. Influenza vaccines are also unique in that annual vaccination is needed, and each year there's a potential for a different formulation. And therefore, each vaccine in each year has a slightly different safety characteristics. An excellent example of this interaction between company-specific manufacturing processes and annual strain changes was a CSL Fluvax example. According to recent manufacturer-published investigations, CSL found that virus components novel to the 2010 formulation compared to prior seasons combined to overstimulate the immune system of some young children, triggering increased fever and fever-related seizures. Moreover, according to CSL, laboratory studies appeared to show that increasing the levels of virus splitting agent in the manufacturing process potentially addresses this risk. In other words, it was a unique interaction between the novel strains and CSL's manufacturing process that contributed to this new safety risk. It was a risk not found in other vaccines that season in Australia, even though they were antigenically equivalent. Additionally, the study of influenza vaccines more generally is complicated by the fact they are often administered with a wide range of other vaccines. And it's also complicated by the fact that there are multiple licensed vaccine types, including live inactivated vaccines, trivalent and quadrivalent formulations now, and egg-based, cell-based, and recombinant vaccines now all available. Lastly, it's prudent for FDA and PRISM to be ready to study influenza vaccines because their use of medical countermeasures during pandemics, where evaluating their safety is even more challenging because they occur under emergent public health circumstances. Next slide. So this slide is just a to illustrate my prior comments, there are a wide range of vaccines that are potentially co-administered with flu. The main take-home message is that almost every vaccination given to children and even adults, even though it's not shown here, can potentially be given simultaneously with flu vaccine. And teasing out inferences about causal attribution is one of the key challenges of any influenza vaccine safety study. Next slide, please. This slide shows one of the key study questions for our study. Having just said that a wide variety of combinations of concomitant vaccination exist, we found in the PRISM febrile seizure study that the most likely combination was the co-administration of Prevnar 13 and flu for U.S. among U.S. clinicians. This is important for several reasons. First, the 2010-2011 influenza season was the first time that Prevnar 13 was being administered together with flu. Secondly, it was being given with a seasonal trivalent inactivated vaccine containing the pandemic H1N1 antigen. So we wanted to provide real-world experience of the safety of giving both the expanded pneumococcal vaccine with this first seasonal trivalent vaccine with pandemic H1N1. Thus, Dr. Kwai and colleagues sought to evaluate whether the risk of febrile seizures when PCV13 was given on the same day as depicted in the above calendar, all given on Monday, was different to giving those vaccines on separate days, and just as an example here, provided on Monday and then the following week on Friday, but not necessarily in that exact sequence. In other words, does one vaccination regimen result in a lower cumulative febrile seizure risk than the other? And I'll stop there, and I'll let Dr. Allison Quiet go from here. Thanks.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you, Dr. Nguyen, for that really nice introduction. On behalf of the Mini-Sentinel PRISM team, I'm here to present our findings on risk of febrile seizures after trivalent influenza vaccines during the 2010-11 influenza season. Next slide, please. In the United States, there are a handful of studies that have looked at risk of febrile seizures following trivalent inactivated influenza vaccine, or TIV, in the 2010-11 influenza season. The first is the Vaccine Safety Data Link, which is a collaboration between the Centers for Disease Control and 8 medical care organizations. Investigators in that study found that 2010-11 TIV was associated with a 2.4-fold increased risk that was statistically significant, and this was adjusted for a 13-valent pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, also known as PCV13 for short. A similarly increased risk was also seen for PCV13. In addition, investigators found some evidence to suggest that same-day TIV and PCV13 vaccination was associated with an additional 7.3 cases of febrile seizures per 100,000 children when compared to separate-day vaccination. However, no formal statistical test was done for that particular comparison. In February of 2011, these results were presented to the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, which is a group of medical and public health experts that develops recommendations on how to use vaccines in the U.S. The group did not recommend any changes to the vaccination schedules for either TIV or PCV13. However, the vaccine information statement for TIV was updated. The update was to inform providers and caregivers about the increased risk seen with concomitant TIV and PCV13. Next slide, please. Another relevant analysis was conducted in the Vaccine Adverse Reporting System, or VAERS. VAERS is a passive surveillance system in which healthcare practitioners or patients can submit reports of potential adverse events. Investigators found disproportional reporting of febrile seizures following a particular TIV product, Fluzone, when compared to other inactivated vaccine products. The signal was concentrated in children 6 to 23 months of age, and it was not seen in other products other than Fluzone, that is. In January of 2011, the FDA posted a notice on its website describing the VAERS findings. They also told the public that they were further investigating the signal. The FDA Centers for Biologics Evaluation Research funded our group to conduct this study as part of this follow-up investigation. Next slide, please. We asked two questions in this study, both among children 6 to 59 months of age during the 2010-11 influenza season. First, we asked whether exposure to TIV or PCV13 was associated with a greater risk for febrile seizures when compared to unexposed periods. Secondly, we asked a different question. We asked, assuming children received all vaccines, does administering both vaccines on the same day lead to greater risk for febrile seizures when compared to administering them on separate days? Next slide, please. We examined these questions in PRISM, or the Post-Licensure Rapid Immunization Safety Monitoring System. As previously mentioned, PRISM is a vaccine safety arm component of the FDA-sponsored Mini-Sentinel pilot program. Mini-Sentinel has been developed to conduct active surveillance for medical products. And PRISM data partners currently include five health insurers. Next slide, please. In this study, we used data from three data partners within PRISM, specifically Aetna, HealthCore, and Humana. We looked at children 6 to 59 months of age vaccinated between July 1, 2010 through June 30, 2011, and the vaccines of interest were TIV and PCV13. We also collected data on DTaP-containing vaccines to adjust for the potential confounding influence due to concomitant vaccinations. And like the vaccine safety data link study that I referenced earlier, we used a self-controlled risk interval design. In this design, we compare the risk of an event in a post-vaccination risk interval to that in a self-matched control interval that reflects the baseline rate in the absence of vaccination. And the strength of this design is that it adjusts inherently for time constant or relatively time constant factors, such as chronic conditions. We used a risk interval of 0 to 1 day post-vaccination and a control interval of 14 to 20 days post-vaccination, like the vaccine safety data link study that I referenced earlier. Next slide, please. Vaccines were identified in claims and immunization registry data. We also validated vaccines found in electronic data using medical records if they were available. We tried to get the record of the visit if it was available, and if it was not available, we attempted to get the child's immunization history. Following medical record review, we excluded cases that had live attenuated influenza vaccine or the 7-valent pneumococcal conjugate vaccine rather than TIV or PCV13 exposures in the medical record. Next slide, please. We initially identified febrile seizures using ICD-9 diagnosis codes for seizures, simple febrile seizures, complex febrile seizures, or other seizures, and these codes were found in either the inpatient or ED settings. We later obtained medical records to confirm these febrile seizure events, and two pediatricians blinded to vaccination timing reviewed each case and determined if case criteria were met. The adjudicators considered the cases confirmed if there was a seizure in fever within 24 hours or diagnosis of febrile seizure. We excluded cases that had specific criteria outlined in the American Academy of Pediatrics Treatment Guidelines, and namely these are history of afebrile seizures, metabolic disorders, or CNS infection or inflammation. We also excluded seizures that were described as focal unless they were part of a diagnosis of complex febrile seizure. Next slide, please. Our eligible study population consisted of roughly 1.9 million children ages 6 to 59 months of age enrolled during the study period, and among them, approximately 840,000 children had TIV, PCV13, or DTaP-containing vaccines identified in electronic data. And of the vaccinated children, 252 had a febrile seizure event in claims data in the risk or control interval. Next slide, please. Next, we conducted medical record review of the 252 potential febrile seizures identified in electronic data. Of these, 86% had charts available to adjudicate case status. 152 were confirmed for a positive predictive value of 70%. Of those not confirmed, 19 were excluded because a seizure was ruled out, while 7 were excluded because there was insufficient documentation to verify the seizure event. And 8 cases had a seizure documented but no documentation to verify the presence or absence of fever, and 22 cases were further excluded because they were afebrile. And finally, 8 cases were excluded due to other reasons such as metabolic disorder, CNS inflammation or infection, or history of afebrile seizures. Next slide, please. We also validated vaccination status in medical charts. We were able to obtain the majority of charts to confirm vaccination exposures. This ranged from 79% for TIV exposure and 91% for PCV13 or DTaP exposures. When medical charts were available, we were also able to validate nearly all vaccines. Where medical charts are available, we were able to confirm TIV or influenza vaccine in 98% of cases. We were able to confirm PCV13 or PCV in 94% of cases. And finally, we were able to confirmed DTaP in all cases. Because the vaccination confirmation rate was high, we included vaccines identified in electronic data and medical records in the primary analysis. Following chart review, 5 cases were excluded because a seizure event was determined to occur outside the post-vaccination risk or control intervals, and another 5 were excluded due to documentation of LAIV or PCV7 in the chart. Next slide, please. Next, I'd like to take a moment to describe the characteristics of the vaccinated febrile seizure cases. Most occurred in the first 2 years of life, and most resulted in a visit to the emergency department without hospitalization. Next slide, please. And about a third of cases occurred in children receiving more than one vaccine of interest on the index date. This demonstrates that concomitant vaccination was quite frequent. Next slide, please. Next, we conducted an analysis to address our first question, which was whether TIV or PCV13 vaccination was associated with a greater risk for febrile seizures when compared to no vaccination, compared to unexposed periods. And we did this by estimating relative risk and attributable risk comparing exposed versus unexposed periods. Next slide, please. We used conditional Poisson modeling to estimate relative risk comparing exposed to unexposed periods. We started with bivariate models for each of the 3 vaccines. Next, we adjusted for age and calendar time. And finally, our single primary analytic model contained terms for vaccination, age, and calendar time. Some more about our age and calendar time adjustments. We determined the shape of the age and calendar time risk curves prior to including them in the age and calendar time adjusted models. And to do this, we included person time from the underlying PRISM cohort. Specifically, we used a quadratic spline with a single knot to adjust for age, and a quadratic spline with 6 knots to adjust for calendar time. Next slide, please. The unadjusted relative risk point estimates for TIV, DTaP, and PCV13 comparing exposed to unexposed periods were each above 1. PCV13 was statistically significantly associated with an increased risk of febrile seizures. Next slide, please. When we adjusted for age and calendar time, results were similar. Next slide, please. And when we further adjusted for concomitant vaccinations, the relative risk for TIV and PCV13 attenuated slightly, but the point estimates were similar. PCV13 was no longer statistically significantly associated with the risk of febrile seizures, and the DTaP relative risk point estimate attenuated greatly and was close to 1.0. Next slide, please. We just presented our relative risk estimates comparing exposed to unexposed periods. To quantify the magnitude of increased risk on the absolute scale, we also estimated attributable risks or risk differences comparing exposed to unexposed periods. We calculated attributable risk by age and weeks, since the baseline risk is known to vary dramatically by age. We used a formula based on the incidence rate ratios from the primary analytic model, and we then applied the baseline rate of febrile seizures in PRISM claims data. We then adjusted the baseline rate downwards using the positive predictive value of claims codes obtained from medical record review in this study. Some assumptions that we made when calculating attributable risk were that the incidence rate ratios were assumed to be constant across age. We determined the baseline rate using a quadratic spline for age. The positive predictive value was based on chart review of cases occurring in the control interval and was assumed to be constant across all ages. Next slide, please. What we found was that the attributable risk for each of the 3 vaccines was below 4 excess cases per 100,000 doses. The highest attributable risk was seen for PCV13, followed by TIV, and the attributable risk was pretty negligible for DTaP. The peak attributable risk was seen at 72 weeks of age, or approximately 16 to 17 months of age, when the baseline risk of febrile seizures is highest. The lowest attributable risk was seen at 260 weeks of age, which is roughly 59 months, when the baseline risk of febrile seizures is lowest. Next slide, please. We also calculated the attributable risk estimates for TIV and PCV13 comparing vaccination to no vaccination based on the worst-case scenario. And we did this by calculating attributable risk based on the upper limit of the 95% confidence intervals for the relative risk. Based on these assumptions, the attributable risk estimates for TIV range from 0.9 to 7.1 per 100,000 doses, and for PCV13, they range from 1.2 to 9.2 per 100,000 doses. These transiently increased risks are quite modest, given that the baseline risk of febrile seizures in this population is approximately 2,700 per 100,000 children, in those 6 to 39 months of age across their lifetime. Next slide, please. We just addressed the question of whether TIV or PCV13 exposure was associated with increased risk of febrile seizures when compared to unexposed periods. Next, we address a different question. If children received both TIV and PCV13, did administering both vaccines on the same day lead to a greater risk for febrile seizures when compared to separate day vaccination? And we calculated the difference in attributable risk for same-day vaccination minus that of separate-day vaccination. These estimates were derived from the incidence rate ratio estimates from the study design that we just described. Next slide, please. This concept is depicted here in this cartoon. On the top is a hypothetical example of same-day vaccination, while the bottom shows a hypothetical example of separate-day vaccination. In this hypothetical example, the attributable risk for same-day vaccination is shown in purple on the top. And in this hypothetical example, the attributable risk for separate-day vaccination is represented by the red and blue cylinders stacked on top of each other on the bottom of the slide. Next slide, please. We then examined the question of whether the attributable risk for same-day vaccination was the same as the attributable risk for separate-day vaccination. Next slide, please. I just visually illustrated the concept of comparing the excess risk of febrile seizures following same-day versus separate-day TIV and PCV13 vaccination. Next, I'd like to show how we did the calculations here. We calculated the excess risk associated with same-day versus separate-day vaccination by taking the attributable risk for same-day vaccination minus the sum of the attributable risk for TIV without concomitant PCV13 and the attributable risk for PCV13 without concomitant TIV. And the attributable risks themselves were derived from the incidence rate ratios based on the conditional Poisson model that contain specifically terms for TIV, PCV13, the interaction between TIV and PCV13, and adjustments for age and seasonality. To determine whether there was any meaningful difference in the attributable risks for same-day versus separate-day vaccination, we calculated 95% confidence intervals for the estimate via Monte Carlo simulations. Next slide, please. Assuming children received both TIV and PCV13, we did not find any evidence to say that receiving them on the same day was associated with a greater risk for febrile seizures when compared to separate-day vaccination. In fact, the point estimate suggested fewer febrile seizures with same-day vaccination. However, the result was not statistically significant and the confidence interval wide. Next slide, please. And finally, for the discussion, next slide, please. Before I state my conclusions, I'd like to put the PRISM results in context with the prior VSD results. The first thing you will likely notice is that the relative risk point estimates are statistically significant for the prior VSD study, but are not in the current PRISM results. However, we consider the results consistent between the two systems because there is so much overlap in the confidence intervals. Also, the relative risk point estimates are above 1 for both studies. Though we think the results are consistent, an important contribution of the PRISM data is that the confidence limits are narrower. This means that we are able to rule out higher magnitudes of risk than we could before. Next slide, please. We also compared the data on same-day versus separate-day vaccinations of TIV and PCV13 from both studies. In PRISM, the point estimate suggested fewer febrile seizures with same-day when compared to separate-day vaccination. This result was not statistically significant. The VSD study indicated more febrile seizures associated with same-day when compared to separate-day vaccination. However, no confidence limits were calculated for this estimate. Next slide, please. Before concluding, I'd also like to point out the strengths and limitations of this study. One of our biggest strengths is that we use a self-controlled risk interval design. This adjusts for time-constant or relatively time-constant factors like race and chronic conditions. Another strength is that two pediatricians independently adjudicated the medical charts of all potential cases, and they were blinded to vaccination timing. We also adjusted for age and calendar time in an analysis. And finally, this was a large study empowered to detect incidence rate ratios of a nearly twofold increased risk. As in all epidemiologic studies, this study also had its limitations. First, we did not validate all vaccine exposures, but when we were able to, over 90% of vaccinations were confirmed. A sensitivity analysis that I didn't present also suggested that vaccine confirmation didn't affect the results or change the resulting conclusions. Another limitation is that we were underpowered to detect more modest incidence rate ratios. However, this is the largest study to date on risk of febrile seizures following TIV or PCV13 during the 2010-11 influenza season and provided the narrowest confidence intervals to date. Next slide, please. So in conclusion, we found that the relative risk estimates for TIV and PCV13 comparing vaccination to unexposed periods were both above 1. However, TIV DTaP and PCV13 were not significantly associated with risk of febrile seizures in the primary analytic models. We cannot rule out the presence of increased risk for TIV or PCV13. However, if such increased risks are present, the magnitude of the relative risk would likely be lower than originally thought. We can also say that any increased risk on the absolute scale would likely be modest if they existed. We say this because the magnitude of the attributable risks under the worst-case scenario are quite modest in size. And finally, we conclude that same-day vaccination with TIV and PCV13 was not associated with statistically significant increased risk of febrile seizures when compared to separate-day vaccination in the 2010-11 influenza season. Next slide, please. And finally, I'd like to conclude by thanking my many collaborators in the study from FDA, the data partners, our mini Sentinel PRISM team, and our clinical adjudicators. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you both Michael and Allison for two great presentations. It's very nice to see that the Mini Sentinel pilot program is providing what seems to be some pretty important insights into the potential increase in risk in associated with the influenza vaccines. And in this analysis, it looks like that you did not see a statistically significant increase in that risk. I do have a couple of questions, but I'd like to remind everybody who is dialed in that we'd like to hear from all of you. If you have any questions, please use the chat function on your screen through the webinar. Submit those questions. We'll get those right away and call on you to ask those questions. While you're thinking of your questions and typing them in, I do have a couple to perhaps kick off the discussion. Allison, I guess this might go to you. It looks like a very comprehensive analysis with some very sophisticated regression modeling and a lot of attention placed on how you actually implemented the self-controlled design. A couple questions that I have are with regard to the potential for other vaccinations occurring both in the risk window as well as in the control window. When you looked at the claims profiles from the data partners, did you observe any interesting trends that you didn't expect ahead of time? So, for example, during the risk window, which I realize was only one day, but also during the control window, did you observe other vaccinations during those times?
We looked at the claims data. The most commonly administered vaccines with influenza vaccines were specifically DTaP-containing vaccines, as well as PCV13, which we looked at in the study. We also did a sensitivity analysis at one point, excluding kids who received concomitant MMR or MMRV vaccination on the same day as TIV, and it didn't change our results. So with us, we think that any other concomitant vaccinations likely did not influence the results greatly.
Okay, great. Thank you for that, Allison. That's very helpful. I do have some questions on the line, so I'm going to call on Lena Titiaveski for her question, and then we also have a question from Ray Woosley, who will, Ray, I'll call on you after Lena. So, Lena, if you're able to, please unmute your line by pressing *7, and when you're ready, go ahead and read your question.
Hello, this is Lena. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much for a wonderful presentation. It was very interesting, and I enjoyed reading the report. I think Allison partly answered my question, but just as a follow-up, I wanted to find out what is the rationale for singling out DTaP as the concomitant vaccination out of all possible concomitant vaccinations that may be co-administered at the time of the influenza vaccine? Is it based on the increased risk that has been seen in the previous literature, or are there any other drivers?
So I would say there are mainly two drivers. One of the main drivers is when we presented these results to the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Because two of us involved in the study, Grace Lee and I, were also involved with the prior vaccine safety data link results from the 2010-11 influenza season. And when Grace presented those results to the advisory committee on immunization practices, one of the main questions was, what was the influence of DTaP-containing vaccines? Because they were the second most commonly administered vaccine, second to PCV13, in being administered concomitantly with TIV. So there was this question still surrounding, from the VSD study, what was the role of DTaP-containing vaccines? And then the second reason was, along with 2010-11 TIV and PCV13, DTaP-containing vaccines have, for the most part, not been associated with risk of febrile seizures, but there is one study conducted in Europe, in Denmark, I believe, that found an increased risk of febrile seizures following a particular DTaP-containing vaccine that is not licensed in the U.S. So we looked at DTaP-containing vaccines for that reason, although studies in a prior study in the U.S. did not find an increased risk of febrile seizures following DTaP.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thanks for your question, Lena. The next question will go to Ray Woosley. Ray, if you're on, please dial *7 and then go ahead and read your question when you're ready. Ray, are you still on? If you are, just dial *7. Okay, well, as Ray's getting on, I'll go ahead and read the question that he had. So I think this might either go to either Michael or Lena. Either Michael or Allison. Regarding the biologic plausibility, are there any expected differences in the incidence and magnitude of fever with regard to different types of vaccines? Michael, do you want to try to take that one?
Sure. As we presented in the intro slides, the ones that have been previously identified to be associated with febrile seizures have been the live vaccines, the measles containing, for example, as well as the what we know now to be the fairly reactogenic whole cell pertussis. But since then, there have been significant changes in manufacturing processes to make especially the DTP or the DTaP vaccine significantly safer in terms of pyrogenicity. One of the main motivating factors in launching this study was the increase in the number of antigens covered in the Prevnar pneumococcal vaccine from 7 to 13. And we wondered if there was a difference in real-world experience in terms of the febrile seizure rate. And so that was one of the motivating concerns. I hope that answers your question.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, Ray, is that you?
Yes, I'm sorry. I couldn't get off mute. I'm not sure if I expressed my question well, but it gets to the mechanism of febrile seizures in this population, and my question really is: are the vaccines that have the highest incidence of seizures the same that have the highest potential for pyrogenicity? And it gets at prevention. If there is a big correlation, you might think that rapid control of fever could prevent seizures.
It's an interesting question. I have not looked back at all of the rates in the clinical trials of fever and compared them to the vaccines that have been associated with febrile seizures. But in general, clinically, we don't know the relationship between the fever and the seizure. And even when you do get a fever, if you try to take an antipyretic, whether it's Tylenol or Motrin or what have you, it doesn't necessarily protect you from getting a seizure. So it's not unclear, as well as different types of the height of the fever. The occurrence of febrile seizures is not associated with either the height or how fast the fever comes. We don't exactly know why, or the association between the fever and the seizures.
It may be that it's seizures, not febrile seizures. Is that possible?
Can you elaborate more?
Well, it gets at the mechanism. I'm trying to get at the mechanism. Is it really just the patients are having a high temperature and that causes some subset to develop some some form of epilepsy or seizure, or is it totally unrelated to the fever? Is it a mechanism perhaps based on susceptibility of ion channels or something like that?
I think your train of thinking is a good one. So far they've uncovered several febrile seizure genes, FEB1 through 5, as well as other genes, SCN1, that predispose to having convulsions. There very well might be further relationships between the genetic predisposition and the co-occurrence of fever and seizures.
It's interesting. This SCN is also the one that's that gene family is associated with congenital long QT and sudden death.
That's right.
Fascinating. Thank you. And I should have said earlier, and I would have if I could have gotten off mute. Very nice work to the people responsible for executing on this. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for your question, Ray. Next, we have Ben Comer, and then after Ben, then we'll then Carlos Diaz Granados. You would be after Ben. So Ben, if you're on the line, just dial *7 to unmute and go ahead and read your question.
Sure, thanks. Allison, I just wondered if you had any general thoughts about using the MiniSentinel database versus other databases for research, and if there are any improvements that you would suggest. Thank you.
So, Michael or Allison, did you hear the question?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question, please?
I think it was getting at are there other databases that could be potentially useful for doing these kinds of analysis? Ben, chime in if I didn't summarize that.
Yeah, and just if you had any recommendations for improvements to the MiniSentinel database itself.
Sure, I can take a shot at the question and see if Michael wants to add anything further. Or Dr. Nguyen wants to add anything further. So first, some of you on this call may or may not be aware that the Vaccine Safety Data Link is doing a further follow investigation study of this topic, looking at other vaccines, not just PCV13 and influenza vaccines. So they're doing a more comprehensive study, and I think their data are complementary to what we are doing. So I think that's one good place to start. They have really great data. In terms of the way that MiniSentinel PRISM can be improved upon, I think one of the issues that we sometimes face is the amount of time that chart review takes. However, I think we're working on that a lot, and we're finding ways to improve our efficiencies in terms of working with our data partners. Michael, did you want to add anything further?
No, I agree. I think you hit it right on the head in the sense that the time to really validate, that needed to really validate these exposures and outcomes with medical records is on the longer side, certainly, on the order of months rather than weeks. Additionally, what you saw here is that a lot of these conditions, even with 4 data partners and millions of doses, they're just rare. Even though we could detect a relative risk all the way down to 2, it turned out that the true risk is probably below 2, and it would have been nice to have even more statistical power. I'd say those are the 2 largest things across the board for any outcome that we study after vaccination. Because they're rare, We need to validate them with medical records, and we just need more size, more statistical power.
Great, thanks. The next question comes in from Carlos Diaz Granados. Carlos, are you on the line? Just star 7.
Yes, can you hear me?
Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for the presentation. Very nice. I'm just wondering whether the results remain similar when you consider a different risk period, maybe 2 or 3 days rather than the 1 day post-vaccination.
We actually pre-specified the risk interval 0 to 1 day a priori or beforehand because prior studies have found that the appropriate risk window is 0 to 1 days, and so we thus didn't look at any other risk windows, simply because if we extend the risk window, we think we'll be washing out the period of increased risk. So, for instance, if we looked at 0 to 2 days and the risk interval is actually only 0 to 1 day, then we would be attenuate the relative risk.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I think that's it that we had for the queue of questions. I will finish with another question, perhaps to either of the presenters. So if anyone else that's dialed in would like to ask any questions that haven't been asked already, now's your time to go ahead and submit those via the chat box. In the meantime, my question, both Allison and to Michael, you know, it seems like any time that you do a mini sentinel assessment or in fact any time that you're utilizing claims linked to registry data and you're specifically looking at medical encounters over defined periods of time within the pediatric population, you always learn something new. And so I'm wondering if during this set of analyses, did you learn something new that might be useful for future pediatric vaccine studies, both, you know, with influenza vaccine or any other vaccine for that matter? Did you learn anything that might inform the next study design or the next analytic technique that could more systematically be incorporated? Maybe not. Michael, Allison, if not, that's okay too.
Well, I think the take home message is that, at least for the vaccination program, is that the concept of simultaneous vaccination, at least according to this data, seemed to be safe. And I think that's a really big take home message from such a powerful study. And it does not seem to portend increased risk, and that families and moms and dads and their children can rest at ease. That at least when it comes to flu in that season and in PCV13, it's another study to show that our vaccines are safe.
Okay, great. Great. Thanks a lot, Michael. Well, that brings us to the end of the presentation. I'd like to thank Drs. Nguyen and Kuai for the terrific presentations. I'd also like to thank everyone who tuned in for today's webinar. The presentation materials, including the audio from today's webinar, will be posted on the Brookings website over the next few days. In addition, I'd like to remind everyone that we're also hosting another webinar next Tuesday, July 29th, and the focus of that webinar will be on a recent mini-sentinel medical countermeasures surveillance field test. So that's a very unique study. Please tune in for that. And we'd also like to send another invite shortly for the registration link for those who have not yet registered. We're looking forward to your participation next week and for future events. So thanks again for participating, and have a great afternoon.